Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll put context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, and clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. Welcome, I'm Jeremy Max. Coming up on the program, flights grounded, tempers frayed as OR Tambo buckles under controller shortages. Global shockwaves as Trump targets Venezuela, what it means for South Africa. The Rand holds its nerve. Cautious optimism builds, though, for 2026. And Africa or bust, why 2026 is crunch time for South African SMEs. It's Monday, the 5th of January. Now, this past weekend, persistent flight delays at OR Tambo International Airport, with air traffic and navigation services acknowledging human resource constraints, travellers facing longer wait times, connections were disrupted, and real frustration building at the country's busiest air hub. Airlines, airports and passengers all feeling strain. But what does this say about the state of South Africa's aviation ecosystem and the urgent fixes needed to restore reliability and confidence? I'm joined now by Guy Leach, who's editor of SA Flyer magazine. He's one of the country's leading voices on aviation. Guy, a very warm welcome. And first of all, what's your read then on these delays at OR Tambo? How serious are they in terms, or were they in terms of operational impact?
Yeah, hi, Jeremy and your listeners, and Happy New Year to everybody concerned. Well, let me start off by saying that, by trying to put a positive spin on it, by saying that they've done better than I thought they would. I thought that they were going to hit the wall around about Christmas time, and so they've managed to get it into the new year before their systems hit the wall and it started falling over. But now, to put some realistic light on the whole thing, it's really not good. And in fact, AT&S is speaking with forked tongue about the whole thing. Initially, they were saying that the problem was staff shortages. Now they're trying to blame the weather. The reality is that AT&S is just not living up to its promises. It's been making significant promises and undertakings and giving information out to say that the staff shortages were being dealt with, that lost skills were being enticed back, and that the problem would be resolved. And in fact, I was quite skeptical about them saying that a couple of flight procedures would be reinstated on Christmas Day. Holden below, in fact, one or two Polokwane were actually reinstated on Christmas Day. But the point that they don't make in their public statements is that they're actually going backwards. Sure, they are getting some flight procedures reinstated, but at the same time, they're losing key ones. On the 7th of December, about nine that I just picked up from a scan through the notices to airmen, as they're called, had been cancelled, and these were on absolutely key airport hubs, notably, obviously, Cape Town, Durban, and OR Tambo. So it's getting worse, not better, and this is why the system has fallen over. And I think that at risk of rabbiting on here, the reality is that they've been expecting too much from the staff members, the air traffic controllers, if you like, that they've managed to persuade to work through Christmas. And finally, they've just sort of said, okay, well, that's it. My overtime is done. I'm tired and I'm just not coming to work.
When we talk about air traffic controllers, it's a global issue, though, isn't it?
Very much a global issue. And that's why South African air traffic controllers are in demand around the world. That's why it's proven so difficult for AT&S to entice back those they've lost. They're really valued in places like Australia and the Middle East, where traffic is growing exponentially. Here, you know, there's, if I may be so bold as to say, there's still a toxic culture within the entire AT&S organization, where old skills have been forced out and hopefully replaced by new skills, but that's just not happening. So they're not succeeding. We saw in the United States, air traffic controllers just not coming back to work because they hadn't been paid. This is a really big issue that is affecting skills supply around the world.
Guy, these delays that you're referencing, how do they impact airline operations, from fuel costs and scheduling knock-on effects to reputation and even commercial viability?
Yeah, I cannot emphasize how strongly they affect, because AT&S talks about, oh, we've had 3 or 4 minute delays. That's absolute nonsense. Yes, although departure delays may have averaged 3 or 4 minutes on for most of the flights. The problem is that it all knocks on, and it means that other aircraft can't land. In fact, we've seen Air Link, for instance, has produced numbers that show that 50% of their flights were significantly delayed. 99 out of 204 flights were delayed, and a lot of them were delayed because of landing delays. Now, obviously, they can't just fly around indefinitely because they run out of fuel, so they had to divert to places like Gaborone and Durban. And this really affects the South African tourism economy in particular, because it means that people will go away having missed essential connecting flights onwards back to their destinations. It means that the entire reliability of the whole infrastructure, of the whole ecosystem, is suddenly called into question. And people will now no longer be confident booking onward flights, booking destinations, and so on. And the problem yesterday has, in fact, continued on into today as well. So it hasn't gotten any better.
Is there a concern that global airlines might start to rethink capacity or route when it comes to South Africa?
I think there's a very real concern, because South Africa has been trying really hard to entice global airlines to come to South Africa. The most successful initiative, remarkably successful, is the Cape Air Access Initiative in Cape Town. But if you can't get people onto your flights, because the domestic system is breaking down, or because flights have been stacked for 45 minutes while they try and get them on the ground, or because the system can't handle the weather, which it should be able to, then obviously they're going to rethink it. There are so many different places competing for passengers. And right now, the entire airline industry around the world is under enormous constraints because of a lack of supply of new aircraft. There are now 5 or 6 year delays in aircraft deliveries because of supply line or chain problems. What with a couple of that with pilot shortages as well, and airlines are tending to pull back on routes rather than expand routes.
Guy Leach is the editor of SA Flyer magazine. Guy, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at midday.
Now, the world waking up to a geopolitical earthquake this past week as the United States launched a full-scale invasion of Venezuela, a move already sending shockwaves through global markets, diplomatic alliances, and energy security. But beyond the headlines, what does this unprecedented escalation really mean for the international order? And crucially, how is it going to ripple down to countries like South Africa, already navigating fragile economic conditions, shifting global power blocks, and deepening geopolitical fault lines? I want to give you a perspective from Sean Frazau, who's public and political affairs strategist at Bolt BPI in London. Sean, a very warm welcome to you. Let's start with the complicated one, the legal grounds and how the US is claiming that this extraction of Nicolas Maduro was justified. There is much debate around that today, is there not?
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for having me. You are right. In this instance, the US have essentially bypassed international law. The U.S. administration isn't relying on the U.N. or war powers. They are essentially leaning entirely on U.S. domestic criminal law, specifically a 2020 indictment for narco-terrorism. So essentially, their legal argument is that Nicolas Maduro ceased to be a legitimate president years ago and became the head of a criminal enterprise, the Cartel de los Soles, or Cartel of the Suns. So in Washington's eyes, isn't an invasion of a sovereign nation. It is a high-risk police raid to serve an arrest warrant on essentially what they describe as a fugitive drug lord who just happened to be living in a presidential palace.
You talk about it bypassing international law. Does it breach international law, or do you think the United States is simply redefining that by force?
Well, let's make no mistake. This is essentially a breach of the UN Charter, specifically Article 2, Paragraph 4, which forbids using force against another state's territory. But what we are also seeing is an attempt to redefine the rules by force. The U.S. is setting a new, very aggressive precedent that sovereignty is a privilege you forfeit if you turn your state into a hub for transnational crime. So it is a might makes right moment that says if your justice system won't handle it, the U.S. will borders be damned.
The question, of course, now is who is effectively running or is going to run Venezuela in practical terms. Donald Trump saying at that news conference at the weekend that it now forms within the orbit of the United States. Who is actually going to run it and make those decisions, do you think?
Well, I guess that's the million-dollar question, right? And frankly, it's pretty chaotic. On paper, under Venezuelan law, Vice President Delcy Rodriguez is now the acting president. But then, as you've mentioned, you have Trump explicitly stating that the U.S. will run the country, and he assigned that role to an American official, Marco Rubio, who is the Secretary of State, also the National Security Advisor, also the National Archivist, and I guess now also kind of Viceroy of Venezuela. But overnight, we saw Acting President Rodriguez moving away from initial defiance, stating that they're willing to work with the U.S. on a governance solution. So practically speaking, what you have is a dual power situation. The Venezuelan military still holds kind of guns on the streets, but the orders are being shouted from Washington. Now, this might create a bit of a vacuum where no one knows exactly who to obey. And let's also not forget that at the same time, you have the official Venezuelan opposition party led by Edmundo González, who most Western governments regard as the legitimate winner of the 2024 presidential election in Venezuela. And Trump has ruled out the possibility of the opposition party ruling Venezuela. So the struggle for power in Caracas is currently chaotic and I think will be chaotic for the foreseeable future.
On a broader canvas, how much dangerous precedent has been set? How concerned, for instance, should Colombia be, or Cuba, or for that matter, even Greenland?
It sets a really a dangerous precedent, and it undermines, I would say, the U.S.'s credibility on this instance as well, right? So at the same time, if I were Iran, for example, I would view this as an existential threat. They might see kind of a fellow anti-American leader snatched from their home and likely accelerate their nuclear power program, for example, as a deterrent. At the same time, you have Russia, who might use this to validate their own actions in Ukraine. So, you know, if I was a country with a leader coming to the crosshairs of Washington, I would be worried. But at the same time, it neutralizes any moral high ground that the U.S. might have, essentially giving their rivals a bit of a whataboutism card, because it's really difficult to defend a rules-based international order when you've just essentially proven that the rules don't apply to you.
Sean, fundamentally, though, this is all about oil production, control, and access. And is it fair to say that U.S. energy interests are now openly shaping policy in Venezuela?
Oh, yeah, I think the mask is completely off. In previous years, we've heard about democracy, human rights, and fair elections when the U.S. would have kind of tried to topple a regime. And now that message is very explicitly transactional. So we've removed the problem. Now our companies are going to fix the oil. Energy dominance isn't just a side effect anymore. It's essentially being presented as the primary dividend of this operation. And it's a return to a very old school style of foreign policy where commercial interests and national security are one and the same. Let's not forget that this removal of Maduro was supposedly about drug trafficking, even though Venezuela accounts for only about 5% of all illegal drugs trafficked into the U.S. But since his removal, there's been no mention by the Trump administration of going after the rest of the cartel or combating the drug trafficking. Instead, this has a conversation been about oil.
And just finally, South Africa quite understandably has condemned the actions at the weekend. Do you think it's a meaningful diplomatic signal or merely a symbolic protest that no one's going to listen to?
I mean, it's largely symbolic, but it does carry, I would say, some diplomatic weight. South Africa is essentially speaking as a voice of the global south and potentially the voice of BRICS as well. So they can't stop the U.S. military. I mean, they can call for emergency UN meetings, but the U.S. does have veto power, so they won't be able to stop U.S. military. But what they can do is they can prevent Washington from claiming that this was global police action. Essentially, South Africa is ensuring that this goes down in history as a unilateral act of aggression, preventing the US from building any real international consensus around the new government.
I'm going to leave it there with my thanks. Sean Frazar, public and political affairs strategist at Bolt PPI London. I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, the Rand has started 2026 with unexpected strength, catching, I think, many businesses and investors off guard. I guess the big question now is whether this is the start of a more durable re-rating or just another window before volatility returns. I'm in conversation now with Harry Schertzer, who's Chief Executive Officer of Future Forex and a regular guest on our program. Harry, a very warm welcome to you. The Rand's strength at the start then of this year, is it fundamentally justified, or do you think it's mostly a global dollar story?
Hi, Jeremy. Great to chat to you again. And it's a combination of both, really. So we have a situation where the dollar has had its worst year in 8 years. So it's definitely some dollar weakness in there. But over and above that, we can't discount the fact that the Rand has performed particularly well this year, even against other emerging market currencies. And so it is a combination of both. But I do think that the Rand has had a stellar 2025. In fact, it's the Rand's strongest ever year since 2009, and we're at levels that we were only previously at in 2022. So we're in somewhat unprecedented times, given political instability of late.
So let's park the dollar then. What do you think are the key forces that are doing the real heavy lifting for our currency right now?
So it's a few things. The first is the GNU. The market really likes the GNU. It prefers it to an ANC-only government because I suspect it's some form of needing to have decisions passed by multiple parties rather than being able to do it in isolation. And I think the government really, or rather the market, really appreciates that. Over and above that, we see that our infrastructure is doing really well. Take Eskom, for example. We've had 231 days of no load shedding. I mean, this is pretty unprecedented versus what we've seen in the last few years. It's been more than a half a year of no load shedding whatsoever. That's clear signs that South Africa is turning a corner. And over and above that, if you look as an international investor, we recently had the finance minister say that the SARB say that our inflation target has reduced from 3-6% to 3%, which is a lower inflation target, which basically means that your money is worth more in Rand terms as an international investor. So all of this is inspiring investor confidence and as a result, strengthening the Rand.
Having said that, Harry, how fragile is the strength, do you think, if global risk appetite turns or even if US rate expectations start to shift? That could be of concern.
Yeah, I always say that when America coughs, South Africa gets a cold. And this is exactly what I'm referring to. If something happens which creates more instability in the world, the first or the majorly affected countries are typically those that have nothing to do with what happened in the first place. So if America decides to go to war or similar, it'll be South Africa and other emerging market currencies that will take a big knock. So we definitely are a fragile nation in that sense and heavily affected by that. But on the positive side, we are in an interest rate cutting cycle at the moment, both locally and in America, which means that actually risk sentiment is likely to improve in time should nothing strange happen. So if 2026 plays out with no unexpected turns, we should actually see further strengthening of the Rand as the dollar, as interest rate cuts happen in America and the dollar effectively weakens as a result.
You'd be watching, Harry, of course, the crisis in Venezuela unfold with what kind of consequence or implication it could have for our currency.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's an example of something that could go the wrong way. That said, what it is doing is it's strengthening gold even further. And as a major exporter of gold, South Africa is actually somewhat benefiting from that instability, which is quite surprising. So that's why the Rand continues to do well, even in light of the Venezuelan news. When gold does well, it's the one thing that we have as South Africa, which actually goes with instability, is the fact that gold tends to go up. And as a major exporter, that helps us.
And in early trade today, I see gold bullion up by over 2%, which endorses exactly what you're saying. Harry, I note that you say the market likes the GNU, but are there domestic policy or reform missteps that could unwind the Rand's momentum?
Oh, definitely. I think you'll remember that back in, was it April, May, during the finance speech. We had to have the finance speech delayed twice because the GNU couldn't agree on the VAT situation, whether we were going to increase VAT or not, because the DA were on one side of the fence, the ANC were on the other side. And that's something that the market hates. The market does not like the inability to deliver even a speech on the day it's supposed to be delivered. And so we can see that the more infighting there is, the more the market reacts negatively. And so as long as the ANC and DA can get on and ultimately agree with each other, amongst others within the GNU, can all agree with each other and come to a conclusion together, that's something the market will appreciate. But if there are major misalignments which can't be solved between the parties, that's the sort of thing that could really, really hit the RAND negatively.
Strategically, Harry, how should South African companies, in your opinion, be thinking about hedging in an environment like this? Do you lock in gains or do you stay flexible?
I'm always one to lock in gains. And the logic is that if you're, let's say, an importer, your costs are in dollars, but your selling price is in rands, which means that if you're trying to almost stay flexible, unless you increase your prices locally, which is quite difficult to do, you're going to have a situation where you might lose your gains due to dollar strength, due to having to pay more now for your goods. And the same is true in reverse for exporters. So what I think is, as a business, if you want to be responsible and reduce risk and mitigate risk, I think locking into prices makes a lot more sense. That way you lock in your profits or your future projected profits, and you ensure that whichever way the RAND goes, yes, you miss out if it goes your way, but you also don't get hampered if it goes the other way. So it's just a risk-averse way of dealing with it, which most businesses should try and do, in my view.
Do you think exporters are already at risk of margin pressure if the RAND holds these levels for too long then?
Yeah, absolutely. So exporters are obviously not going to be as happy as importers with the RAND strength, but I don't think that's a reason for exporters not to do this, because for all we know, even though the RAND is super strong at the moment, for all we know, it just gets stronger. Like I said, with interest rates cutting cycles, there's a good reason for the RAND to get even stronger than where it is. And we know with purchasing power parity, we still have quite a long way to go for the RAND to be at almost fair value. So I think whether you're an importer or an exporter, we can't predict where the market's going to go, but there's reasons to believe that it could go up or down from here. And so that's why locking into prices does make the most sense for both sides.
Always appreciate your time. Harry Schertzer, Chief Executive Officer, Future Forex. We'll talk again. Thank you so much.
Top stories to keep your eyes and ears on.
Now let's end the program with this, and it is an important one. South Africa's SMEs are being challenged to rethink what, and I quote, going global really means. As Africa's growth takes center stage after South Africa's G20 moment last year, advisors are arguing the next big expansion opportunity isn't necessarily Europe or the United States, but markets like Lagos, Accra, and Nairobi, with local e-commerce set to reach something in the region of 130 billion rand and an estimated 1 trillion rand export opportunity across the continent is big. And the question is whether SMEs are ready to act. Well, Nunqedo Mtentwe is the Managing Director of Vantage Advisory and joins me on the program now. And a very warm welcome to you. And you argue that SMEs should stop defaulting to the United States and Europe. What mind shift then do you think is still missing among African and particularly South African entrepreneurs?
I think the starting point, Jeremy, in terms of, you know, the mindset and the direction and where we are heading towards in 2026, one, I think it's very important to bring this into context that when it comes to the trade reality in Africa, especially intra-African trade, it is relatively low. You know, we're talking just below 20%. So that means these are the countries in Africa trading with each other. Compared to, you know, the way most of these African countries trade with the likes of Europe, the likes of Asia, and we've seen Asia really coming in heavily to Africa. So therefore, the question has always been to say, look, if we are not trading amongst each other, you know, and we're looking, you know, too far, then there might be a missing opportunity. And that is where right now the SMEs, especially in South Africa, have to take advantage of the opportunities that will be coming, especially at the very big success that we had with the G20 and the B20. And, you know, I had very good discussions with number of some of the people who were leading some of the task forces. And the heart of that, Jeremy, what I picked up with all of the discussions I was having was that there is a sense and the call that you know, African countries or SMEs have to collaborate for them to be able to be successful, and not only to look at the local market within KZN or Gauteng or Western Cape only, but to say, look, how do you collaborate with other partners that you can be able to penetrate other countries in Africa, and especially with an opportunity around the AFCFTA, an African Continental Free Trade Area. And that's what we need to be taking that opportunity at, and that angle. So I think that's where SMEs right now, as they start to relax and to take holidays, but to say, how do you think not only locally, but across Africa?
I want to pick you up on collaboration in just a moment, but let me try and counter your argument by asking you this question. Is the continent genuinely easy to enter, or are SMEs underestimating sometimes the complexity of cross-border trade on the continent?
You're spot on, Jeremy. We have to face the reality that as much as Africa has this market that we say about 1.3 billion people, right? And it is really anticipated to be one of those profitable markets. But that doesn't mean all of that market of 1.3 billion you're going to be able to really access, or those are buyers that can be able to buy these products, all right? So out of that 1.3 billion, it's a very small market that can be able to really, you know, buy your products. But at the heart of that, and the reason for that, it is a huge lack of investment, especially when it comes to the infrastructure. I was having a chat with one of the ladies who does, you know, some wellness products, and she said something that was very interesting, Jeremy, to say, for her, it's better to export either to Europe or Asia, right, in terms of the cost, compared to export to Africa. And at the heart of that is what we're talking about, is the lack of investment infrastructure and the lack of cross-border payments, for instance, you know, that we've seen. But with African Continental Free Trade Area starting to kick off, and I think that is where we have to put in the momentum. We have to raise this voice. We have to put pressure to African governments to start really investing heavily, you know, in terms of infrastructure, so that there is a free flow when it comes to goods, your goods from South Africa to Kenya or to DRC, for instance.
Let's assume that we get that right. The 1 trillion rand export opportunity does sound huge and enticing, but how realistic is it for smaller firms and not just well-capitalized players?
And that is where then, Jeremy, I'm emphasizing the importance around collaboration, because if you are Jeremy and you are going directly by yourself to say, I want to sell some of my goods, for instance, in Rwanda, right? Chances are, of course, you're going to struggle, right? And the opportunity for SMEs is collaboration, is to partner with some of the credible players, is to partner with some of the local players in that particular country, for instance, right? And that's where the success is at. And I always say that, how do you do that? You know, and you'll be surprised, Jeremy, that, you know, to penetrate some of these countries, the starting point I always say is to say, look further, don't look further, just do your research, find out if are the number of the chamber of commerce that we have in South Africa in relation to that country. For instance, if you want, let's say, to ship your goods to Hong Kong, there is a Hong Kong South African Chamber of Commerce. And your starting point is to say, look, let me start to talk to these folks so that they can be able to direct me and, you know, in a better position, so that whenever I'm about to export some of my goods, I've done my due diligence. And that's where the SMEs have to look at, is collaboration, not only just to go directly by yourself.
I do understand the compelling argument that you make about collaboration, but often that does come with risk and uncertainty, particularly if you don't find the right partner. And that is not always easy.
No, that's correct. And that's the nature of the, of the business in Africa. And we've seen some big retailers from South Africa, for instance, really withholding or coming back as a result of the trade with some of these countries. But the opportunity here, Jeremy, is you're not expanding for the sake of expanding. What is important is to say, look, which are some of the African countries that have high growth markets, right? And that is your starting point, that have a bit of high growing middle class. a bit of demand, rising demand in terms of goods and services. And that is your starting point so that you are not just entering a market that you're not familiar with and that you're going to struggle, you know, when you get into.
Just a final one and a quick answer. You did mention payment systems, but SME should also take note, I would imagine, about things like regulation and currency risk. Those are also risk factors that need to be taken into account.
No, you're spot on, you know, and that's where when you look at the policy recommendations and the CFTA really comes in there is to say, look, how do we really minimize and how do we really provide some of the solutions in relation to these particular, you know, risk factors that some of these businesses really come in. And right now, the opportunities, of course, you know, the digital infrastructure, something that is very important. And South Africa, I mean, when it comes to Africa, we are leading in relation to that part. But again, is to always, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. There are some, you know, e-commerce partners that are already playing in Africa that have proven to be success. So therefore, partnering as well with some of these reputable players, it does really limit your risk. But it's very important that when you enter Africa, of course, your risk strategy is something that is well scrutinized and you face the reality and the regulations around, you know, exporting some of these goods. And that's where the AFCFTA is trying to say, look, how do we harmonize some of these trade regulations so that when it comes to when crossing the border, you're not having the challenges. And that is the biggest risk, especially in Africa, that you find at the border, you get stuck for 5 or 10 days. And we are looking at the fact that all of those challenges now are being implemented. Mm. And I think about 48 countries have started to really come in and to bring in their agreements around that.
Lunqedo Mthethwa is the Managing Director of Vantage Advisory. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.